Għal dab oħra ċaċ xwirepora mikrofon u semmilkom l-akoma l-edizzjoni oħra ta' sensira I'm alright. Il-programm tal-lum, għal-min jisma il-programmi diretti bita jkunu ħirġina xin fakkarkom dejjem ikunu fuq is-sit tal-Campus FM taħt webcast tistaw issibu il-programmi kollha mhux bista din is-sensiela imma ta' sensili toħra fuq suġġetti varji. Imma min qed jisma' l-programm jaf li qegħdin lej l-aħħar tax-xahar u fl-aħħar tax-xahar ta' Ġunju meta ħarġet l-ewwel darba l-edizzjoni ta' dan il-programm kienet għaddejja l-aħħar fażi tal-kompetizzjoni euro din id-darba bħas-soltu qajmet interess. Fost diversi pajjiżi mhux l-inqas bej il-Greċja u l-Ġermanja li kellhom logħba storika rebħu l-Ġermanja. Dikinhar fost il-mistiedna speċjali kien hemm Merkel. Bl-iskuża tal-futbol s'intendi għamu ħafna kummenti u osservazzjonijiet fil-medja xi wħud ukoll jiġibud bis-sima. Ma nistax ma nikkummentax ftit kif naħseb tobsru ħafna mis-semmija li fi żminijiet li jkunaw dan il-logħob internazzjonali aktar u iktar Ewropej manke tad-dinja f'Malta timmanifesta ruħha dina x-xhieda koloniali ħafna drabi u ngħid koloniali kważi kważi mhix qiegħda korretta għaliex aħna l-iktar li aħna maqsumin hawn Malta fil-maġġor parti huma bej Italjani u l-Ingliżi. Ngħidu x'ngħidu il-futbol huwa parti mill-kultura tagħna, hija s-sistema, hija l-imħabba. Ħabba lej żewġ timijiet tajbin fl-assenza tat-tim nazzjonali tagħna bir-rispett kollu li jagħmlu ħafna sforzi u napprezzaw dak li jagħmlu f'isem Malta, imma m'għandniex ir-riżorsi u m'għandniex in-numru ta' nies li minnhom joħorġ tim li jista' jħabbata mal-gbarnet, m'aħniex waħedna, hemm pajjiżi żgħar bħalna, l-Lussemburgu, l-Andorra, jiġifieri m'aħniex nippretendu li jsiru xi mirakli impossibbli, imma mill-banda l-oħra ma nistgħux ma ngħidux li l-manifestazzjoni esaġerata b'tip ta' nazzjonalizmu għal pajjiż ieħor hija ftit stramba jekk ma tajċ ukoll biżarra. Binti kienet Ruma dakinhar li l-Italja rabet mal-Ingilterra, jiġifieri l-ħadd li għadda minn qed jismana dirett u rat il-logħba hemmhekk ma' żewġa ma' dawn kollu wara il-logħba kulħadd mar lura lejn daru. Dan qed insemmu Malta jgħidulek speċjalment in-nies ta' Taslima u San Ġiljan sa tlieta ta' filgħodu sbieħ it-tnejn għadhom għaddejji karozzi bir-rispett kollu ħajkolli ngħidha boloħ idoqqu l-ħornijiet qishom huma Taljani. Ikunu Maltin ħafna drabi li qed jagħmlu għall-aktar mhux biss għax ferħu li rebħu imma għax qegħdin jinku lil dawk li tilfu għax hawn il-pika kbira bejn l-Ingilterra u l-Italja. Dan huwa fenomenu li ma jeżisti jimkien iżjed qed ngħidlek anqas pajjiżu wieħed irid jibda jindirizza din il-mentalità anki fl-iskejjel li da ma stax tagħmel liġijiet li ma tistax toħroġ tajjat fit-toroq għalkemm ngħiduha sa tlieta ta' filgħodu hija kontra l-liġi li tagħmel storbju fit-triq imma nifhem li l-pulizija jkollhom problema biex iwaqfu l-dar entużjażmu li wara kollox ma jistgħux jagħmlu ħsara aktar milli jtelfu l-paċi u l-bon orni tal-pajjiż. Imma l-ar mhix dik l-ar u nerġa' ngħid anke f'għajnejn il-barranin imma anke f'għajnejna li aħna f'sikkitna għax hawn ħafna li huma f'sikkitu din tidher bluha li mhix qiegħda f'posta. Naqta rasi li jekk il-ħamis jitilfu Italjani kontra l-Ġermaniżi se joħorġu forsi dawk li jħobbu l-Ingliżi iduqqu l-ħorn biex jinkuhom. Ma naħseb li mhijiex impossibbli. Għaliex għax l-argument kollu huwa sproporzjonat ma l-interess li wieħed għandu jkollu għal tim favorit. Ħaġa sabiħa li kollok tim favorit hawn ħafna li għandhom, jien għandi tiegħi, imma kollox irid isir ċertu qies u kalkolu. Għaliex qegħdin irrabbu anke l-ulied immaġinaw dawn li joħorġu, it-tfal qed jarawhom jikkupjaw x'qegħdin jagħmlu, huma jibqgħu jagħmlu l-istess u di qed tibqa' tintired. U dan il-fenomenu mhux mifrux f'nies ta' bla skola, f'nies li ma għamluhiex ma' nies li ma sifrux li ma marrux jaraw xi lobbit anke fil-grounds barra, imma qed jagħmluha anki nies li jippretendu li huma maturi. U għalhekk hija problema akbar. Jiena ngħid storikament ġejja mill-laqizmu li kellna f'dan il-pajjiż, bdejna minn taħt il-kavalliri jekk jiġi jżur is-sultan ir-raħal, kulħadd jara kif iżejjen u joħroġ b'nadar u jgħajjat u kważi kważi jintefa' fl-art quddiemu biex juri li huwa jaqbel ħafna ma' dawk l-idejat u jħobbu għaliex dak iż-żmien aktar ma tagħmel hekk forsi aktar issib il-favuri u di komunità żgħira u dik il-marda baqgħet magħna forsi jsallu. Ġrat ukoll fi żmien l-Ingliżi meta l-pika mat-Taljani speċjalment. Fil-kustjoni tal-lingwa u iktar tard ħareġ dan il-fenomenu tal-inkejja ma wieħed għall-ieħor. Imma aktar ma għadda żmien, aktar bdejna nuru li uritna dan il-fenomenu li għaw Maltin li jridu jidru li qishom Ingliżi aktar mill-Ingliżi u għaw Maltin li jixtiequ jinkuhom u jidru li għadhom Taljani u ħossuhom iżjed Taljani mit-Taljani.
Fi 13 ta' Lulju 1949, Sir Gerald Creasy mis-servizzi koloniali Ingliż wasal Malta. Għal dawk li huma gvernaturi ta' wara l-gwerra jidher li kien kemmxejn aħjar minn oħrajn. Huwa twelet Windsor fl-1897 u fl-ewwel gwerra dinjija serva mal-artillerija fejn ġie ferut. Kien wara l-gwerra li ddeċida jidħol fis-servizz koloniali. Fejn għal sentejn għamilha ta' assistent tal-Under Secretary għall-affarijiet ta' dominji Ingliżi. Qabel ġie Malta serva wkoll għal sentejn bħala segretarju ewlieni tal-Kunsill tal-Afrika tal-Punent, bl-aħħar appuntament tiegħu bejn 1947 u 49 bħala gvernatur tal-Kosta Debina, illum magħrufa bħala l-Ghana. Fl-1925 iżewweġ lil Helen u kellhom tifel u tifla. Malli wasal Creasy kien hawn kriżi politika. Il-Partit Laborista nqasam fit-tnejn. Ir-riżenja Pawlu Boffa mimmexxej tal-Partit Laborista iżda kompla bħala Prim Ministru. Meta l-Kamra tal-Kummerċ iċċelebrat il-mitt anniversarju ta' twaqqif tagħha, ftakret li kien gvernatur Ingliż ċivili li bdiet taħtu bħal Creasy. Fl-1949 iċċelebraw ukoll l-75 anniversarju żewġ banet fil-Belt, La Valette u Kingzone. Kienet sena li matula il-Prinċipessa Eliżabetta għattat fuq xar fosna bħala Mart Philip, uffiċjal navali. F'Marzu tal-1950 reġgħet fosna Eliżabetta għal tliet xhur. Sa April tal-1951 baqgħet tiġijaw kważi tliet darbiet fis-sena u għalhekk il-Gvernatur barra x-xogħol tas-soltu bħala rappreżentant ta' missiera kellu doveri oħra soċjali x'jaqdi. Meta reġgħet lura Malta Eliżabetta kienet reġina. Waslet hawn f'Mejju tal-1954 waqt li kienet qed iżżur il-pajjiżi tal-Commonwealth. Wara l-waqgħa ta' Boffa rebħu l-elezzjoni nazzjonalisti bit-12 siġġu Settembru tal-1950 huma ffurmaw gvern b'appoġġ ta' elementi moderati. Il-Partit Laborista tella 22 siġġu iżda kien maqsum fit-tnejn. Nofshom ta' Boffa u nofshom ta' Mintoff li jissa beda jmexxi l-Malta Labour Party. Fl-1952, Creasy kellu wkoll jilqa lil ħuh l-ammiral George Creasy li kien qed imexxi l-Home Fleet Brittanika. Fl-istess sena laħaq Commander in Chief tal-Mediterran, Mountbatten. Fl-1953 twaqfet Malta in-NATO Command. Qabel telaq minn Malta, Creasy poġġa l-ewwel ġebla tal-Mater Admirablis, il-kulleġġ femminili tal-Għalliema. F'Ġunju tal-1952, kif ukoll id-dar tal-infermiera għall-MMDNA fl-1954. Matul il-ħatra tiegħu assista għal tliet elezzjonijiet. Flimkien ma' martu daħlu sew fil-ħajja soċjali u qabel telqu minn hawn kienu laħqu ffurmaw ċirku ġmielu.
Kumment li ma nixtiequx jaħrabli bejn it-tarif li ħriġna fuq il-Gvernatur Creasy qabel ma nidħlu għall-intervista interessanti llum differenti ma' professur minn Minnesota li se jkellimna fuq xi ħaġa partikulari dwar l-Ingilterra u l-Mediterran, xtaqt li nagħmlu fuq il-biblioteka. Il-biblioteka għadha kemm iċċelebrat il-200 sena tal-ftuħ uffiċjali tagħha li kien ħabat fl-1812 ma eluq snin irre George tlieta li taħt tħalna bħala kolonja taħt l-Ingliżi fl-4 ta' Ġunju. Ħaġa sabiħa li wieħed juża daw l-opportunitajiet ta' kommemorazzjonijiet biex jipprofetta ruħu u joħroġ tarif fuq post daqshekk importanti f'dar pajjiż, imma ċċelebrajna l-200 sena tal-anniversarju tal-ftuħ tal-librerija. Hi ħaġa sabiħa tella twirja saret taħdita. Fl-istess ġimgħa għall-irwieħ saret taħdita mill-Professur William Zammit biex ifakkar il-ħajja tal-biblioteka qabel ma fetħuha l-Ingliżi fl-1812 u sejħula l-librerija irja. Sa mill-1776 u anka ftit qabel, il-kavalieri kienu ħasbu bis-serjetà de Tersan, wieħed minnhom li baqa' jissemma kavalier Franċiż, fi żmien de Rohan, Grammastru Franċiż, li jibdew biblioteka minħabba l-attenzjoni kbira li l-Franċiżi kienu jagħtu li kollhom kważi kull pubblikazzjoni li toħroġ Pariġi fl-ewwel edizzjoni tagħha. U bekk għandna daw it-teżuri żbieħ. Ma niftakarx li meta għalaqna 200 sena, jiġifieri fl-1976 jew fl-1996 mhux ħafna meta nbena l-bini tal-biblioteka. Ma niftakarx li saru xi ċelebrazzjonijiet. Għal-inqas ir-riċenti ma niftakarhomx. Għaliex qed ngħid hekk? Għaliex tajjeb li l-anniversarji inħarsu lejhom, imma tajjeb ukoll impoġġuhom f'perspettiva bilanċjata. Hawn Malta jiena ninnota aktar minn oħrajn għax sensittiv għall-isbilanċ li jeżisti kontra l-Franċiżi. Ħafna drabi ninsew x'valuri kbar kulturali, soċjali ħallew il-Franċiżi f'Malta sija kienu kavalieri u sija jekk kien Bonaparti. Wara kollox, kienet bis-saħħa ta' Bonaparti li dawk l-arkivi uniċi fid-dinja tal-kavalieri baqgħu, għaliex fil-waqt li huwa waqqaf l-ordni u biha ħadu gost ħafna il-Maltin li kellhom ċerta skola għaliex l-ordni huwa sal fit-tmiemu, imma ma ħallihomx jieħdu l-arkivi magħhom. Bonaparti minn hawn kien ser l-Eġittu u l-iktar ħaġa li mar jagħmel barra raġunijiet politiċi biex joħnoq lill-Ingilterra għadha pitada fil-vant minħabba l-kummerċ, imma mar biex jiskopri kultura orientali tal-Eġizzjani, tal-Farawni. U fil-fatt hekk inħarsu llum lejn Franza ninnutaw li din l-influenza kollha li ġab minn hemm fuqha bena l-imperu, l-amara, il-ħwejjeġ. L-istil ta' kull ma kellu l-imperu kellu ħafna djun lejn Romani, m'hemmx dubju, neoklassiku, imma anki lejn stilijiet orientali ta' kultura qadima, ċivilizzazzjoni qadima. Tantu hekk li llum kif jaf kulħadd fil-bitħa tal-Louvre m'hemmx ħlief piramida tal-ħġieġ kbira esagerata apposta biex twassal dan il-messaġġ kemm Pariġi għandha timbru li jaf dejn lill-Eġittu. Għandna biżejjed monumenti Ingliżi il-Belt biex ifakruna fil-preżenza Ingliża, dawk li huma monumenti tal-kavalieri, mhux aħjar naraw li l-krettu għalihom jingħata lill-kavalieri. Hemm forsi nintebħu li meta tagħmel hekk ma tibdix timxi f'dik it-triq bħalma semmejna aktar kmieni tal-Maltin, Taljani iktar mit-Taljani jew Ingliżi aktar mill-Ingliżi. Naddu issa biex il-laqgħakom ma' professur Nabil Matar li kien Malta għal-vaganza kif se jgħidu għand kollega tiegħu professur ieħor, in-nazzjonalità oriġinali tiegħu hija Palestinjana, nafu l-Palestinjani kemm jistudjaw f'diversi pajjiżi differenti, m'għandu storja verament sabiħa, biżejjed ngħidilkom li dan kien ostaġġ għal siċċur kif se tisimgħu ħjar. Imma għandu wkoll focus ta' studju fuq l-Ingilterra fil-Mediterran. L-aktar f'sekli 16-17 qabel ma' Malta daħlet fl-Imperu. Welcome to our studios. It's a pleasure to have you on this program, which normally deals with British colonialism in Malta. Your background is vast enough. You come from Minnesota University. You found yourself in Malta. How come you are in Malta?
Thank you, first of all, for the invitation. Really appreciate that. And I really enjoyed myself in Malta. It's been now a week and a few days, and unfortunately I leave on Saturday. The reason I came is because I have a friend here, a childhood friend, who's been living here now for a year with his wife in Nashar. They moved here and they extended an invitation, which I was very happy to accept. But also, wherever I go, I like to see if there's material for me to do research on, because I work in the Mediterranean region and basically relations between the Western Europe, chiefly France and Britain, and North Africa and the Middle East, the kind of, you know, Christian Islamic world. And years ago, this friend sent me a title of a book by Professor Gottfried Wettinger. I was very honored to meet at the panel we had at the university, and it was about slavery in Malta. And he sent that to me, and I read it. I realized there's an enormous amount of material that has to be looked into in Malta. And then last year, actually, I met Professor Franz Chaparro at the conference in England, and again he gave a paper about kind of Maltese captives, etc. So I realized, you know, this is an area where, although I'm not working with Maltese captives as such, or captives in Malta, as Professor Wettinger does, I realized there may be material here that I need to look at, particularly material in Arabic that I'm interested in examining.
Did you find what you were looking for?
Actually, I found at the Franciscan Library, yes, these were manuscripts by a Muslim captive, an Arab Muslim captive, in the early 17th century, who had been given the task, instead of being sent into the galleys, he seemed to have been a learned jurist. And he actually was given the task of writing down the conjugations, the scansion of nouns, verbs, basically a grammatical dictionary of the Gospel of John in Arabic. I don't know which version of the Gospel, because he has 82 chapters there, which is not what the Gospel of John is. But basically what he was doing is being told to write, this is a verb, this is a noun, and then he'd explain it, which you might think is rather boring, and I think he found it boring as well, because you find his handwriting. But sometimes he got a little bit angry, and so he would insert his own emotions.
Comments.
Yeah, and that was very interesting. So I was kind of reading that, along with other material that he had written. So, I mean, he was working there.
And most probably the Franciscans had never really accessed
this is what is
what they had. They didn't realize the treasure they had.
I mean, that is what I've concluded, is that this guy must have realized at some point that nobody's reading what he's writing. These are, you know, heavy manuscripts. I mean, 200, 300 pages, very well written, beautiful handwriting, very also kind of demanding in time, because what he would do is write the noun or the verb in red ink, and then the comment would be in black. So imagine that as he's doing that, he's shifting.
It must be one of the earliest in that genre of writing, most probably.
I don't know in terms of earlier medieval material, because I haven't been able to make it to Medina, although I hope to visit in the future and see what kind of manuscripts there are there. But this is very unusual, because I couldn't figure out what its purpose was. And he's writing it for a friar, whom he mentions as Francesco Almalti.
Which could be a nickname for all we know.
I don't know. But he respects him. You know, he says the great brother at some point, frater, brother.
Yes.
But on the other hand, as I say, I couldn't figure out what he was doing.
Interesting.
Because it gets boring. I mean, let's say he likes Jesus. He said it's the name of a man. And then perhaps on the same page, the name of Jesus recurs. So he says, it's the name of a man. So why is he doing that? And then sometimes, you know, he'll explain, Jesus for us is, he is a prophet of God, may God bless him, etc.
Because he was a Muslim.
Yes, he is. So, as I say, I'm still trying to figure out.
It's a challenge, anyhow.
Yes, I'm trying to figure out what he was doing. But as I say, sometimes when he gets to terms like Allah, God, you know, other terms that.
Which is still our word for God in Maltese, anyhow.
Oh, is it?
Allah. The only European language, in the EU at least, that calls God Allah.
Ah.
We still say Allah, Allayeni.
Allayeni.
And you would understand that, yes.
I didn't know that, because I was at the center near the presidential palace, the St. James Cavalier, and there's a little
Octavan.
Yes, and it was the names of God. And one of them was, and it was in the European, and it said in the European kind of union, and they had God and, you know, whatever.
And Maltese is written without the H.
Without the H.
The Arabic would be with
an
H.
And I was trying to figure out, you know, where did
Allah,
that come
Allah,
from?
Allah, we lost the sound.
You lost the H, but, yeah. Oh, so that explains it.
Yes.
Because I was trying to, you know, I couldn't
because
figure
Maltese,
out.
Maltese, after all, is a Semitic language and came from Arabic, so we have retained many words, but this is one of them.
But that at least explained why that was there, because I didn't know that. So that was part of the work I did, and there are other manuscripts I was eager to look at, so I've been kind of examining those.
Okay, so we'll be seeing you again, for sure.
I hope so. It's a wonderful location, and I've enjoyed it tremendously. It's a lovely country, I mean, from what I've seen. My friend has been taking me around quite extensively. So, yes, it is a beautiful place. Thank you.
you come from the English department in the University of Minnesota. What is your historical interest? Is it part of your studies or of your research or project?
Okay.
How do they tie in, these two branches?
As with all academics, life kind of moves on and things change. You move in different directions. I mean, you move on. My career started basically doing purely English lit at the University in Beirut, American University in Beirut, and then I finished my doctorate at Cambridge University. And I was working on 17th century English poetry, and actually an Anglican English poet by the name of Thomas Traherne, not a very familiar name. And so that was my interest. It was kind of basically theology and literature and its contextualization in history. You know, why would such a poet write such a material at that particular time? What kind of impact did the theological context and his Anglican context? Because, you know, very high Anglican. So I was kind of trying to see that. And I did that. And I enjoyed it tremendously. And then, you know, I taught at the university in Jordan and then went back to England. In Lebanon as well, when I was teaching there in the early...
And you come from Lebanon originally.
Palestinian, born in Beirut. And
it explains why you were as a childhood friend with Alex.
Yeah, that's right. And so I taught in Beirut, and I was still interested mainly in literature and theology. I mean, these have always been my main concern. My grandfather was the first Lutheran minister in Palestine. So, I mean, I come from a very strong religious background.
Yeah. You're not a minister yourself.
No. My mother wanted me to become one.
There you are.
I became a teacher, so I don't know.
Like in Malta with the Catholic priests, it used to be like that. Guys, they normally pushed into a vocation.
I was teaching in Lebanon, and I was still, as I say, interested in kind of the combination of history, theology, and literature, but mainly, again, with the English scene. And then, unfortunately, in 1986, I was taken hostage and I was kept in solitary confinement for 6 months. I was fortunate...
In the Middle East?
In Lebanon, Beirut.
By other
you remember, I mean, the season or the years of hostage taking.
Oh, yes. Yeah. How? Okay. Yes.
Well, it was after the Israeli invasion in 1982 that basically the collapse of whatever coherence there was. Anyway, so I was thinking...
Quite a colorful life.
I don't know about
that. That is an experience you'll never forget.
No, of course not. Anyway, so after I was released, which I was probably one of the very, 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 very few.
It's always a blessing.
And it was thanks to my wife who did that.
She must have been brave as well, because it's not only surviving is brave, but also how to get people out of
there. Yeah, I owe my life to her.
Of course.
I fortunately had the option of going to the United States because my parents had emigrated there a long time ago and they always wanted me to go there. And I said,
and there is a big community of Palestinians here.
It's
also
it's
in the States,
basically, you know, you go there. But I liked Lebanon. I mean, Lebanon was home and I was perfectly happy. It's just after that I had to leave.
And such a rich historical place.
Very much so. Very mixed place, multi religious. It was wonderful. I mean, at least the Lebanon I've known and the Lebanon I grew up in was an amazing, amazing
and
country.
It had a colorful history. The French were there.
Yeah.
And still influence is strong there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Somehow, you know, after the experience I'd had, the orientation I had in literature kind of changed. I mean, I could not handle the kind of poetry that I hadn't been handling for. And in the United States, I realized, you know, somehow that I could do something with my knowledge of Arabic and my interest in history. And being influenced, like perhaps many, many post-colonialists, by Edward Said and his methodology, he made definitely many of us owe our kind of reflections on our careers and deflections, if you want, to him. I started working on English material in relation to the Arab Islamic world, basically because, you know, what did they think of the Islamic world, the Muslim, and chiefly in the Mediterranean, because that was the first encounter that the British had, or the English, by the British, with them. So I started doing that, short articles, and then, you know, they just expanded. And then after I published my first book in 1998, which was about Islam in Britain, and then a year later, Turks, Moors, and Englishmen, which I just learned has been translated into Arabic. After doing this, and that was a kind of trilogy I wanted, you know, three books on Britain and the Islamic world. And the first was Britain, Islamic Britain. The second one, Turks, Moors, and Englishmen, the Age of Discovery. The third one was Britain and Barbary, you know, the name that had been used for North Africa.
So close to us as well, both of them.
Very much. And then I thought, well, you know, now I've done for the English language archive, let me see if I can do anything with the Arabic archive. And so I traveled to Morocco, spent some time actually, a number of times to Morocco. Morocco has a very, very good archive. So I was trying to find material in terms of the other side of the coin. I mean, I was writing about how the English viewed the Islamic world and the Arabic-speaking world.
Exactly.
You know, how did the Arabs look at England and other parts of the world as well in Western Christendom? So I went to Morocco, and then later I went to Tunisia. And then I started working on the archive that exists also in England and in France in Arabic. So I was looking at material that, you know, letters sent by rulers, captives who sent letters to the monarch, trying to find out what exactly is there in terms of the Arabic archive about Western Europe. Because it has always been said, inaccurately, that the Arabs and Muslims, I speak about Arabs because I don't handle the Ottoman Empire in terms of the language.
Yes.
I deal with the Arabs.
The regions is mostly in the north of Africa, mostly the new regions.
And that's the area which had the most extensive interaction with Western Europe. If you are living in historical Palestine, Lebanon, Egypt, your contacts were with the Ottoman, Istanbul.
Sure.
If you're living in Algeria, in Tunisia, in Libya.
Or in Malta, for the matter.
Or in Malta. I mean, yes, that's the part that
we're
just really
between both
you're
continents.
Between, and in a sense, it's looking more towards the West because it is developing in the West. There's more kind of industry, more production of consumer goods, etc. And there is better shipping as well. That is, I think, the most important factor. So in a sense, you know, these communities in North Africa and Malta were looking westward rather than eastward, simply because, you know, it's like the Mediterranean was divided after Lepanto. I mean, it becomes kind of a line actually crossing through Malta, from Italy to Tunisia through Malta. The eastern part
And that was the reason, after all, why the knights were sent to Malta.
Very true. And in a sense, participated in that.
Exactly.
I'm all right. Illum il-professur Nabil Mata, Palestinian li jallem l-Università ta' Minnesota, qed ikellimna dwar il-preżenza Brittanika fil-Mediterran. Komplu simgħu I'm all right.
So I started working on the Arabic archive and started another trilogy, you know, basically finding material in Arabic, translating them so that we can show that there was interest, there was interaction. Now, clearly the archive is by far smaller than the European archive.
Yes.
The Arabs didn't write
less documents there. Yeah.
Very, very much so. But there are documents. I mean, that's my point.
Yes.
Is that
and most probably they kept records. At least, even to a minimum, but records were kept.
There is. And what we need to do, and not just I hope others, you know, future soon will do, is kind of basically look into the archive.
Discover
Nobody's
them.
Kind of, yes, discover them. Because, you know, you're not going to find huge tomes in the way that you find them in Western European writing about the Islamic world. I mean, you know, you go to England, to France, Spain, not much, Italy, you find huge amounts of writings by travelers, by pilgrims, etc. So you're not going to find anything similar.
By religious orders who tried to
redeem
the captives.
So. Absolutely. And in terms of missions as well to the Middle East. But from the Arabic side, you need to look at what historians call microhistory. Look at associations, look at patterns, look at evidence that is not extensive. And so sometimes, you know, what I would do is be reading, let's say, a text, and, you know, it's all about jurisprudence. There's nothing in it about Europe. But suddenly you get then a page in which somebody tells somebody a story. You know, this guy was traveling and he ended up on a ship that went, let us say, to Marseille. And he went down there and saw this and that here. It's one page in the middle of a book that has nothing to do with Western Europe. And yet, it is a piece of evidence that there is familiarity, there is interest.
And very authentic, because it's written without any other purpose.
Exactly.
Not to
there is
influence
no
oil, anyone.
There is no kind
no
of
manipulation in it.
And it's not a marketing ploy, you know, it's just kind of. So that's what I've started, and that's what I've been working on. And that kind of where the work now, hopefully here in Malta and elsewhere, would kind of feed into that. Because, so I started with that as the first book was in the lands of the Christians, basically the longer accounts by Arab travelers to Spain, to France, and the only Arabic account about America in the 1660s by a Catholic monk from Iraq who goes to Mexico, I mean Central America, he doesn't go to North America. So I translated these, so that basically, you know, you can see major pieces of writing there. And then I moved on to shorter pieces by individuals, some captives, jurists. What was their expression, what was their understanding of Western Europe? And now, hopefully, the final part of that trilogy will be basically a larger study of Britain and France on the one hand and the Islamic Mediterranean on the other, just to see the modes of interaction in terms of religious conversion, in terms of very important factors that have been completely ignored, Christian Arabs who are writing in Arabic, traveling around. I mean, we always think of this kind of, you know, Christianity as being something completely Western. I mean, there's a large population in the East, and particularly in the 16th, 17th century, I mean, with the kind of fragmentation within the Ottoman Empire, the minorities, including Jews, I mean, being very active in trade and travel. I mean, I found accounts of travel, you know, somebody from Aleppo traveling to Mount Sinai to visit St. Catherine, and they write an account, and, you know, what they saw on the road.
Pilgrims' diaries,
very, very much so, and these not been touched. I mean, nobody seemed to know about them. Some of them have been catalogued, some of them have been kind of documented.
How present was Britain in the Mediterranean before it came to Malta?
England, after the Reformation, after King Henry VIII, etc., ended up with its own Anglican institution, which cut it off in terms of trade and cooperation with Spain, becomes its main enemy, France is kind of lurking there. So it had to find new markets, and it had to find allies, and the only allies were going to be in the Mediterranean. So that's when it begins the kind of commercial venture. And it's not kind of a government run. It's not the Queen kind of coordinating that as much as individual kind of merchants. I mean, people who want to make money.
Looking for markets.
Markets and goods that they can sell and buy. And so basically...
Trade, after all. Trade. Because Britain is built on trade.
And that's what it is. So kind of the first entry into the Mediterranean was commercial entry, trying to find markets. North Africa obviously was the stop, because if you're sailing from England to, let's say, Izmir or Alexandria in Egypt, you know, you're going to need supplies, you need water, etc. And they could not moor in a Spanish port or in a French port or in an Italian port. So, you know, they're kind of basically finding supplies in North Africa, and kind of many of these areas, Tripoli, Tunis, Algiers, I mean, these were supply kind of, and then they would continue the journey there. So the beginning was at the time in that context of trade. But the Mediterranean, after Lepanto, had become an area of piracy. Everybody was kind of... Absolutely. Everybody was joining in, because that was the biggest market that you can invest in. And so the English and later the British were taking part in that, the French were taking part in that, the Maltese were taking part in that, the North Africans took part in that. So in a sense, the Western Mediterranean became a very pirate-infested area. Therefore, the first encounter with kind of really on a hostile level was the encounter via piracy and captivity. The North African captured Britons, Britons captured North Africans, but basically it was a trade. You needed people to kind of man your ships, but you also needed the money that you can get back from them. So the first encounter was really that. And what I've been arguing in some of my research is really that was a memory that England could never overcome. I think, because in terms of how it viewed Islam, the first encounter was encounter of captivity. Although how many captives is the project I'm working on now, which is a paper I gave the conference, and I don't think it's high in the way that many historians have claimed, but there was much production of literature, of drama, of imagination that influenced the making of English thought about the Mediterranean, basically the Islamic Mediterranean. And I see that as the main factor why there was an image of hostility towards Islam from the Mediterranean, unlike that in, let's say, Persia or in India. Because at the same time as the English were moving into the Mediterranean, they were sailing down the western coast of Africa all the way to India. They start basically within 20 years. I mean, 1581 is when they kind of, you know, established their first base in Istanbul. 1600 is when Queen Elizabeth kind of charters the East India Company. So, I mean, it's within that same reign. In India, it's very different experiences. A large country, multi-religious. I mean, they never realized where they were, in a sense, religiously. I mean, they knew there was by far more wealth there that they could tap into. The same with Persia. I mean, you know, travel into the Ottoman Empire, go into Turkey, and then over land or via the Persian Gulf. These were very different encounters, and therefore religion did not play a major role there. they traded. The correspondence is very interesting because it's a world that they had no idea about. They're trying to figure out what the terms are, what kind of coinage to use, what kind of measurements to use. I mean, it's really a world of discovery for them. And religiously as well. I mean, India is obviously very rich in varieties of religions and practices, and the English, you know, had no idea what's going on. So notwithstanding the fact that it was run by, you know, a Muslim monarchy, in a sense, the Mughals, they just didn't see it as being that kind. It was just so mixed. North Africa was much more homogeneous. It was very much kind of, you know, and notwithstanding the fact that there were North Africans were breaking away slowly from Ottoman centralization, but it was homogeneous in the sense that really that was completely exclusive.
They were all Arabs?
All Arabs, Berbers, all sorts of slaves from Sahara, but basically Muslim. When the English get into Egypt, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, that's where they encounter the Christian Arabs. And that's a different experience altogether. But in North Africa, and that's the trading ground. That was the most kind of dangerous but also inevitable trading ground. That's where they begin to encounter the captivity experience and therefore the impact of the captivity. So I think I would say that the beginning of the familiarity with the Mediterranean was the trading familiarity. Malta was ambivalent as far as they're concerned because of the knights, and it was therefore Catholic, so it was kind of pretty dangerous. And there are episodes where English captives were taken by the Knights of Malta and kind of ransomed. It's kind of interesting that a little bit later, mid 1600, middle of the 17th century, there's an episode of two English women who came to Malta to preach. And of course, they want to convert the Catholics.
It's under the knights.
Yeah, and they want to convert the Catholics to Protestants. And obviously, they're not taken too seriously, but they're kept in prison. And they write an account. It is published actually in 1660. They write an account about their experience in Malta. That's how Malta would be viewed, as a place where full of Catholics.
Close to the Arab North Africa.
And so, you know, you go to preach to the Muslims or you preach to the Catholics, one way or another. At least that missionary activity was beginning to take place in the middle of the 17th century and going in both directions as well. So the experience, as I say, is trading somehow religious. It's always kind of going to be
religious. Missions were following the trade.
Yeah. Missions will follow the French because they were doing that already. Yeah. And so the English were very apprehensive that the French kind of gain ground in that respect. And indeed, the French did. The English never did, at least until the 19th century. But I mean, there was no way in which England could rival France, you know, in the Middle East in terms of missionary activity, because the French could appeal to the Catholic populations in the Ottoman Empire. It was a large Catholic population, and therefore they had access. And of course, relations between Paris and Istanbul were always, to a large extent, good. So in a sense, the Ottoman administration always kind of turned a blind eye, unless it became embarrassing. But England did not have that kind of access to the community as such. And on the contrary, the French in the Middle East would work against the British, particularly as the British, by the beginning of the 18th century, begin to produce material in Arabic to convert local publications. So trade, you know, some kind of mission.
And politics at the end, obviously.
Because, politics will
come eventually in the end of the 18th century.
Yeah. Well, but even at that time, I mean, they're trying to make alliances, they're trying to make peace treaties, they're trying to ensure safe trade. That's what they want. They want to be able to trade safely, so they want to make agreements. They make agreements. The problem is that kind of the North African region, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, Morocco is a bit more stable at certain periods.
And closer to France in any case.
And in a sense, although, you know, depending on how the wind
Spain turned, was always there as well.
Yeah, and Spain was always kind of the enemy. I mean, Spain could not be forgotten simply because of the expulsion in 1492. I mean, that was something, and subsequently, and the expulsion of the Moriscos in the early 17th century, I mean, 1609, 1614. I mean, expulsion, nearly what, 500,000 Moriscos into North Africa created a very, very, very negative kind of image of Spain particularly. And Britain obviously could capitalize on that because they're Protestant, these are Catholics. It was a triangulation of Catholicism, Protestantism, and Islam within the Western Mediterranean that I would say dominated the commercial, social interaction at the time. I think the change begins for Britain as well as France at the end of the 17th century, when they become by far more developed navigationally. They establish modes of maritime trade and shipbuilding that enables them to have a fleet that was basically, by the end of the 17th century, completely untouchable. And I would say from that point on, Britain begins to dominate the Mediterranean. So long before 1800, a century, I would say a century before begins the conflict between Britain and France over the Mediterranean. You're fighting in North America as well, but the Mediterranean was very important because, that's where you directly get many of the supplies that you need.
Your trade is.
Very much so. And so I would say in the 1670s, 1680s, France and Britain develop long-range cannons. And these cannons would enable their fleet to sail, let's say, into Algiers, or sail into Tunis, or sail into Saleh, or sail anywhere they want. At a distance, bomb the city to smithereens, which they did. And the population there would be able to do absolutely nothing. And I found a number of very, very moving descriptions by Arab writers. There's one writer who was traveling from Morocco on his way to the pilgrimage in Mecca and found himself in Tripoli in 1685. And with the bombardment as was being carried by the French. The descriptions, this is the end of the world because this is new technology. They don't know anything about it. These are new kinds of bombs. And they have nothing to use against them. From that point, it was not just that it was bombing because of conflict. The bombing was basically an attempt to eradicate any navigational maritime ability on the part of the North African coast.
I'm all right. Illum il-professur Nabil Mata, Palestinian li jallem l-Università ta' Minnesota, qed ikellimna dwar il-preżenza Brittanika fil-Mediterran. Komplu simgħu I'm all right.
Everybody wanted to trade. The English wanted to trade, the French wanted to trade, Maltese wanted to trade, the Tunisians wanted to trade, the Algerians wanted to trade, the Moroccans wanted to trade. Everyone wants to trade. And to trade, it's the sea. That's where you go, particularly for North Africa. If you go south, it becomes the Sahara.
After all, that's how the Ottoman Empire was created.
Yeah, that's true. Particularly for these regions where they always felt they had a market that they could take into the Ottoman, into the east. And that's the easiest way to travel. It was still dangerous, but it's at least faster than going by land. To cross, let's say, from Tetuan to Izmir would take probably a shorter time sailing than to go by land. So everyone wanted to trade, but by the end of the 17th century, it's like it wasn't an agreement, it was a rivalry between France and Britain that we want to take over the Mediterranean. So what do? We eliminate all rivals.
The others made space.
Exactly. And so that's what basically begins to happen. And so the entry as a powerful factor in the Mediterranean of Britain, always kind of with France there. Continues into Napoleon.
The intimate enemy.
Yeah, the intimate enemy. It's always going to be there. Begins at the end of the 17th century. The Nine Years' War and then the War of Spanish Succession. One historian has spoken about the Second Hundred Years' War until the Napoleonic kind of conflict. This is a war in which it begins with the elimination of the rival, and the rival is kind of North African trading fleet. Because the bombardments were not just, if you want to bomb piratical ships, let's say. It wasn't that. It was the whole docks, the kind of supply line, everything would just burn out. The French attack on Algiers in 1683, one French commander said that we released 10,000 bombs on that city in duration of 13, 14 days or something. As I say, part of that was an attempt to remove rivals and make those regions completely dependent economically and everything else. If you wanted to go on a pilgrimage, you used a British ship. If you wanted to trade, you used a British ship. If you wanted to
dominating the trade routes. As well as the travel ones.
And that was interesting about Britain. Britain, after the fall of them, Britain also thought of also colonizing. And the first colony, actually, that Britain had in the whole Islamic world was in Tangier in 1662. It came as a part of the dowry, as a present to King Charles II, but they built a bastion. It was a colony that was, Fort Richard, Fort Charles, changed the names of the rivers. It was a landscape that became small England. The English garden was being built there. They had around 4,000 soldiers there with their families. Very, very vibrant community. Performances of Shakespeare were taking place there. And then, basically they were driven out by 1684. But they realized that better to control the routes than the land. And that's what they did. And that, I think, is the beginning of the war with France. Who's going to control the routes? I think by the end of the British takeover.
They ruled the waves.
Yeah, that's right. They ruled the waves. And so the presence by then becomes a presence of power. I think up till the end of the 17th century, Britain is negotiating. the Mediterranean. It's kind of exposed, it doesn't have a very strong fleet, it's trying to ward off attacks, it's trying to also to control its own pirates, because a lot of Britain just went on their own, and they would cause disruptions. You know, sometimes you sign a treaty with, let's say, Algiers, suddenly comes, you know, British pirates and
disrupts the whole setup.
Exactly, disrupted. So they were trying to control
as the knights would do to France, for example, or the Muslims.
With the Muslims.
Same story.
The same pattern. So in a sense, the first stage was a stage of commerce, a bit kind of religious kind of awareness, concerned about religion. The second phase was basically control. And by then, religion is no longer important. They're not interested in converting anyone. They just want to trade. They want to sell you. They want to make you English in order to buy breeches. Yes,
they just wanted outposts in the right places, including Malta, after including all, when the Suez Canal is for
sale. And the sale of British products. I mean, that becomes interesting. And then it's kind of by the 18th century, it's interesting, where they realize, you know, what do? I mean, we don't really care to save your soul, but we want you to be able to smoke our own tobacco. We want you to use our own breeches. And so it's kind of interesting. And
well, Napoleon did call Britain a nation of traders, of shopkeepers, right? Trade was
It's very bluntly stated. I mean, Daniel Defoe, the famous author of Robinson Crusoe, he wrote an account about trade in 1727-28, in which he basically says, very clearly, these North African regions, people there are lazy, very fertile regions. So what we need to do as Europeans, Britain taking the lead, but he's involving everyone else, because this is kind of a new America as far as he's imagining. We need to go down there, and we can do two things. Either push people back, so they can go into the...
Clear the way.
Yeah. Then we populate it. Or we can go down there and make use of the people for the labor.
Manpower.
Yeah, as labor. But also teach them to use our things. And he lists what we need. You know, these are the products we have, so we need to teach them what to use. It becomes, as I say, this kind of mechanism of commercial control via navigation, via commercial, via trade routes. Because by then, the North Africans don't have any shipping. They can't go anywhere, much as they wanted to. And it's kind of interesting that during the Napoleonic Wars, it's kind of very interesting, when France and Britain are busy with each other, actually they are able to come back in terms of building ships and establishing some trade routes of their own, which then are demolished by the beginning of the 19th century. And then, you know, France takes over Algiers, and that's the end of the story. Yeah. But, I mean, it's kind of interesting that when they had a kind of a possibility of regaining and recouping, they actually tried and seemed to have done, you know, relatively well.
Yes.
But, as I say, Britain comes in. Of course, the United States entered the scene as well at the beginning of the 19th century, and then France. And so it ends that. That's how I would see Britain in the Mediterranean, starting as commercial, by the end of the 17th century becoming much more militaristically involved, navigationally involved, and by the 18th century kind of more or less in complete dominance, always with France at its heels, or Britain at the heels of France in that respect. Now, Malta is in the very middle of that, so it's always feeling the impact of these conflicts. Yes, I mean, there's no question that during all these wars, Malta was central, and particularly the French wars, I mean, because Malta was support, you know, obviously
did a lot of commerce in the Napoleonic Wars until...
Yeah, but even in those wars at the end of the 17th century and the 18th century, I mean, Malta was supplying the French. And so, in a sense, it became part of the adversary that Britain had to ward off.
Yes.
And that's where the rivalry for North Africa becomes very intense.
Wem intemmu l-edizzjoni tagħna tal-lum b'dik l-intervista mal-professur Nabil Mata li jgħallem l-Università ta' Minnesota l-Istati Uniti. Nittama li oġobkom it-tarif li waslilkom minn dak li qal huwa wa bniedem simpatiku ħafna u ħaggrazzja ħafna ma' Malta u jixtieq jerġa' jiġi kif naħseb ħadtu l-impressjoni minn dik l-intervista u miegħi ċar xwieqeb ġimgħa d-dieħla tilġob tiltaqgħu ma' mistieden ieħor. Insellimkom.